From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. How did Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s death affect the nation?
He was the one man in our race who was trying to teach our people to have love, compassion, and mercy for what white people had done. When white America killed Dr. King last night, he declared war on us.
That civil rights activist Stokely Carmichael reacting to King's murder in 1968. Ahead this hour, we look at King's legacy. This week marks 50 years since he died. How would you describe his legacy? Give us a call at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the program. Later this hour, we revisit our conversation with Congressman and civil rights icon John Lewis. He wrote a series of graphic novels about the civil rights movement. But first, please meet two avid comic book fans. Growing up, they loved following their favorite superheroes on epic missions to save humanity. But during all those adventures, they felt something was missing. Enough leading characters of color. Fast forward to present day. Location? Atlanta, Georgia. Carlton and Derek Hargrove are on a mission to diversify the comic book industry. The two brothers are the creative force behind the publishing company 20th Place Media. I talked with them about their comic called Moses, which appeared last year. What excites you, Derek, about the comics, the work you're doing now?
Well, I think especially now with all of the new interest in superheroes of color, and we are excited about, you know, bringing out these new characters. Just a great time for all of this.
Yeah.
It's a great time.
And Carlton, what was the new book you unveiled?
Moses is a science fiction comic, but it is sort of an alien abduction story that has linkages to the African slave trade.
Tell me about the extent to which you try to weave African-American history into your comics, into your characters.
Oh, totally. You know, my thought is a lot of times you see people in pop culture say, well, I made a character who happens to be black or happens to be Asian. But I think we should make characters who are intrinsically black or intrinsically a person of color.
And what does that mean, intrinsically black?
That means like the culture of the character is built into the fabric in a foundation of the character. You know what I mean? So what it does is it tells you a story, but it also transmits messages and information about who we are. And ultimately, our mission is to kind of broaden the idea of what it means to be black and tell stories about us to people around the world. So this is a way to do it in a subtle way.
Right, right.
That's why we do it.
More about Moses, please, your lead character.
Yes, Moses, you know, the whole idea came
she.
From... She. Yes, it's a she, yes. She. So the whole idea came from, we like, what if alien abduction was real, right? And we say, well, the thought is, if you get abducted by an alien, how do you come back? So we have Moses, who's a black woman, who has this ragtag team of people that go rescue people who've been abducted by aliens. So we immediately saw an analogy with the Underground Railroad, Harriet Tubman.
Yeah.
So,
well, Derek, how did you two get here? How did you get to this place where you're writing comic books?
Well, we were kids. We acted out all of these ideas.
Yeah. You acted out the idea?
Yeah. We did it well into our 20s also. But no, it's a...
Which is another story, right?
Right.
Whole nother story. We would act out all of these ideas. We would just sit down and talk. We're like, what if this? What if this happened? You know, or we would even have these characters in our mind and say, look, I came up with something slick for this. What if this, and this? And he's like, oh, yeah. But we never wrote it down.
Right, right.
Never wrote it down. Never even thought about trying. Mm. And one day Carlton came home with a book of how to write scripts. And we were like, that's it?
Yeah.
Okay, so what characters, what comics sort of captured your imagination when you were young?
Well, all the stuff that everybody really likes. You know, we liked the X-Men and we liked Fantastic Four and those kind of books. But we noticed even back then that it was like, okay, the characters who were black or minority characters usually weren't as good as the white characters. They were not that well fleshed out, and they usually kind of catered to very stereotypical ideas about who we are. So we noticed that as children. You know what I mean? It was like, it was easy to pick it up.
Yeah, yeah.
Anybody could, so.
But the idea of writing, now that's more than the notion. I mean, you've got to figure that out. That's work. That's studying. But how did that come to you?
Well, at first it's kind of fun. Like he was saying, we would sort of improv. We would have toys, and before I played with the toys, and we would sit down, I would like have a plot.
How close are you in age?
3 years apart.
I thought it was like more like 10.
Yeah.
I thought you were like 10 years
more
older.
More like 10.
No,
because
no.
He behaved that way.
I'm the youngest. It's actually four of us in all.
Yeah.
So
I'm the second. He's the fourth.
Right.
There are two other ones.
So let me play a clip for you. Okay. This is from Bill Campbell. I don't know if you know Bill Campbell.
Yeah.
He's with Rosarium Publishing.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's focusing its efforts on bringing more diversity to science fiction. I don't know that you've talked, maybe you have, about the work that you're doing.
No, well, we
maybe a collaboration.
So we saw him at OnyxCon a few years ago.
Okay, so he says white men have dominated the comic book writing and illustrating space.
So there have always been women, there have always been brown people who have been interested in science fiction, but we just kind of act like they don't or never did exist. We have the sad puppies, but we also have, you know, publishers and who do actively participate in excluding people.
So I'm curious, is there a chance that maybe one day that are you maybe working together, or are you in two different areas, or is it something that maybe could happen down the road?
I'm open to whatever. Yeah, exactly. I mean, like I said, we ran into them at OnyxCon. It was just like very brief. So we're open to work with all kind of people.
Yeah. So the overarching sort of mission of what you're doing here, explain that to me.
The overarching mission is to ultimately, we want to broaden the idea of what it means to be black. We want to give people diverse choices about who we are, what we look like. And, you know, we want to take a story, you know, our culture gets taken all over the world anyway, right? And usually it's in a way that we would not like. So this is a way for us to add to that conversation about who we are for people who are in South America, Africa, Croatia, wherever, and United States.
Were there role models? Usually what happens is you see something, maybe the one person, the one other African-American doing what it is you want to do, and that person becomes your inspiration. Was there anyone like that out there for you when you were growing up?
Tom Floyd.
I was going to say Tom Floyd. Yeah.
The creator of Black Man.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually a hometown guy. He's from my hometown.
Which is?
Gary, Indiana.
Gary, Indiana.
Yes. Gary, Indiana.
Yep. And I remember as a kid, Tom Floyd printed up all these comics and he passed them out at the Village.
Exactly.
Which was a mall in Gary. Yeah. And it was like, wow, a black dude made a comic that who lives in Gary. And it was professional quality.
Yeah.
So you're liking, I would think, what's happening in this space even for African Americans. Look, I mean, Samuel L. Jackson is playing Nick Fury, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that would have to be encouraging for you. That would, it seemed to me, suggest that there is room for you in this space to do something.
Totally. The more people are interested in Black Panther, the more they could be interested in us.
And Ta-Nehisi Coates?
Ta-Nehisi Coates writing Black Panther. I mean, that's a big deal. I mean, here's especially a journalist coming and writing a book from a very intellectual point of view. So that's a great thing.
So tell me about the other book that's available. Nia Griggs and the Comedic Sisterhood of Science.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we actually kind of proud of that one. She's the lead operative in the Comedic Sisterhood of Science. It's an ancient organization that's been keeping watch over the world. And, you know, and they use science as their weapon. I mean, basically, they use science to solve problems. They use science, you know, to, you know, make the world a better place. But they do it, you know, behind the scenes and everything. So we've been, it's a lot of moving parts to that. But Nia Griggs, she's a young music editor that lives in Atlanta. And, you know, and she can summon all of the powers of her ancestors. And she becomes just this goddess. And she kicks a lot of butt.
That's Carlton and Derek Hargrove. They're brothers and the publishers of 20th Place Media, a comic book company based in Atlanta. I spoke with them last year. The latest comic book from 20th Place Media is called Makusa. It's out now. This week, we pay tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., marking 50 years since his death. On August 16, 1967, King spoke at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference's annual convention in Atlanta.
is our hope for the future. And with this faith, we will be able to sing in some not too distant tomorrow with a cosmic past tense. We have overcome. We have overcome. Deep in my heart, I did believe we would overcome.
One conference planner was civil rights icon and journalist Zernona Clayton. We recently reminisced with her.
This hotel means a lot to me because now I still see in my mind's eye clearly the day he and I were standing out here on the corner. We were knocked out. We had a luncheon over at this little hotel that's no longer there, now built right behind the hotel here. And I had planned a luncheon, and there were white people at the luncheon. People had come here to visit Dr. King. You know, that was part of my many jobs, is to arrange for special events for Dr. King's guests. I planned this luncheon, knew that all my details were in order, but nothing went right. They threw the food out, it was all cold. Just everything went wrong. Dr. King kept saying, "What's the matter? What's the matter?" He said, "Well, let's call the manager because we can find out what the problem is because we're getting poor service, poor everything." The manager came, and Dr. King told him we were unhappy, and then it said, and the Dr. King asked one question, "What seems to be the problem?" The manager's response was, "You. You are the problem. You come here and bring these colored people and white people sitting down together to eat, and we don't like it." And then he said, "Well, I hope I haven't insulted you." Dr. King said, "Oh, no, you've given me an enthused moment. I'm going out now and see to it. This will never happen again, that blacks and whites should be able to sit down and meet and greet and eat wherever they want to." So once they threw us out, we were standing outside the hotel on the street, and he looked over here. And this building was under construction. It was going to open in a few months. And he said, "Well," to me, just the two of us, he said, "Well, I guess all we have to do now is look forward to this hotel, that will be our hotel of hope. That we hope they'll do the right thing. We hope they won't treat us like these people just treat us. So we'll just hope that they'll be, you know, treat us right and equally." And that was, I remember that so vividly. And of course, the hotel, as it was planning to open, we decided we'd give them an opportunity to see if they were what we hoped it would be. So my job was to help plan the convention, which was coming up, the annual convention of SCLC. And I came over here to talk to them about our details. And Dr. King said, "And let me know how they treat you." So I went back and told them I got good treatment, and they were kind and courteous and wonderful and warm. And that's how we ended up getting here to our convention. That was August of 50 years ago.
That was civil rights icon and former journalist Zernona Clayton. It's on Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. Georgia Congressman John Lewis wears many hats: civil rights leader, principled politician, and graphic novelist. His story and the story of the civil rights movement are told through a three-part graphic memoir called March. My colleague Adam Ragusea spoke with Congressman Lewis about the series. Here's John Lewis describing the book's portrayal of his life.
It tells the story of my growing up in book one on a farm in rural Alabama, 50 miles from Montgomery, outside of a little place called Troy. And growing up there, I remember when I was 4 years old, my father had saved $300, and a man sold him 110 acres of land that my family is still on today. And we would visit the little town of Troy, or visit Montgomery, or visit Tuskegee. I saw these signs that said white men, white women, colored women. And I would ask my mother, my father, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, why? They was, "That's the way it is. Don't get in the way. Don't get in trouble." But the words and the teaching of Dr. King and the action of Rosa Parks inspired me to find a way to get in trouble. And I got in what I call good trouble, necessary trouble. And I think as young people and people not so young read March, especially book one, and later book two, and book three, they will understand that I, for one, and many others, grew up and becoming committed to the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence.
Congressman, I think about you and the work that you did in Selma and elsewhere with Martin Luther King. I think about you often as I'm watching the Black Lives Matter movement play out. There was a moment when some Black Lives Matter protesters were blocking interstates in downtown Atlanta recently, and I was struck by how even people like Mayor Kasim Reed, who's very sympathetic to the movement, was saying, listen, guys, you know, I respect your right to protest. I hear where you're coming from. I share your anger about police brutality, particularly as it is directed disproportionately to African Americans. But please do not block public highways. I'm curious, Congressman Lewis, when you guys went over that bridge in Selma, did you have legal permission to block that road?
When we attempted to march, on March 7, 1965, from Selma to Montgomery. It was 600 of us. We were walking in twos. We never attempted to block the bridge or block the highway where we left the bridge. We were walking in orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion. It was like military discipline. We didn't try to disrupt or traffic. We were taught to act in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion. We studied, we prepared ourselves.
Yeah.
And we later got a court order from a federal judge after we were beaten and left bloody, and the judge granted us the permission to walk all the way from Selma to Montgomery. And because of the violence that happened in Selma on Bloody Sunday, President Lyndon Johnson ordered federal troops to protect us all the way from Selma to Montgomery.
Yeah.
People have a right to march in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion.
Well, when people criticize the Black Lives Matter movement, one of the things they say is that it's important to maintain law and order, rule of law in public spaces. Was that not the justification that was given for beating you and your friends on that bridge in Selma?
The governor of Alabama at the time, Governor George C. Wallace, the Alabama state troopers, and other law enforcement individuals said, in effect, that the march would not be allowed. They ordered us to disperse and return to our homes or to our church. But in America, as Dr. King was saying, you have a right to protest for what is right. You have a right to dissent. It's protected and guaranteed by the Constitution. Freedom of assembly. People all across America, and I believe the President of the United States and the federal courts, felt like our rights have been violated.
Congressman Lewis, I'm curious, when you look at Black Lives Matter today, what do you think about the movement from a strategic standpoint, from a tactical standpoint? How do you feel about the kinds of protests that the people who are protesting under this banner have mounted?
Well, I have met with some members of Black Lives Matter in Atlanta and other parts of America, and I said, whatever you do, do it in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion. And you try to appeal to the conscience of people. There's a lot of issues that they're confronting, but always respect the rights of others. When you see police officers, when I see police officers, and I tell Black Lives Matter people, respect the officers. I said to them over and over again, I said, thank you for your service.
Yeah. Congressman Lewis, the world that we see in the graphic novels in the March series is one in which you are using these tactics that are now very familiar to us after having lived through the Civil Rights Movement or seen it in the recent history, which is tactics like marches, tactics like sit-ins, civil disobedience. You brought one of those tactics back recently. You and your Democratic colleagues in the House staged a sit-in on the House floor demanding that the Republican leadership allow votes on gun control measures. Unfortunately, it looks as though that sit-in did not have quite the effect that you were hoping for. How do you look back on that experience?
I look back on it with a great deal of not just drama, but it's something that we had to do. We have been trying for many, many years since I've been in Congress to get to Congress to do something about the proliferation of guns in our society. We lost too many of our children, our brothers and sisters, our mothers and fathers, and it seemed like no one has listened. I felt in talking and meeting with some of my colleagues that we had to do something that was out of regular order.
Yeah.
And we spoke on the floor, and then we just took seats. And every place that I've traveled since then, all over America, people walk up and say, I'm a conservative, I'm a Republican, I'm a Democrat, but thank you for what you did. Airline pilots walk back when I'm riding the plane, the flight attendants say thank you on the streets, they say thank you. We have to do something, and I think we will. This is not the end of what we tried to do. We out of the Congress until sometime in September. We will continue to find a way to push the issue, to dramatize the issue, to make it real that we have to put an end to gun violence. We're losing too many of our citizens. You know, I met President Kennedy in 1963 when I was 23. I met Martin Luther King Jr. in 1958 at the age of 18. I got to know Robert Kennedy. These three young leaders, killed by guns, and people like Mega Evers in Mississippi, and there have been many others of people in the movement that were shot and murdered every day in a city like Atlanta or Chicago. Someone has been murdered, and we have to stop it.
That's Georgia Congressman John Lewis speaking with my colleague Adam Ragusea. His story and the story of the civil rights movement are told in the three-part graphic memoir, March. John Lewis marched with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. This week, many pay tribute to King, 50 years after his death. In 1961, King spoke with Eleanor Fisher, a reporter with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, who later worked for NPR. Fisher interviewed King for a documentary series about Atlanta she was producing for the CBC. These conversations were discovered in 2013 by WNYC Public Radio in New York. We'll play a portion of that first interview, but first, some context. It was November 1961. JFK was our recently elected president. When MLK sat down to speak with Eleanor Fisher, the Freedom Riders had completed their trip from D.C. to Charlotte just 6 months before. Only weeks before, King had met with the president, urging him to sign a new Emancipation Proclamation, this time aimed at racial segregation. A few minutes into the interview, Fisher asks him if he was aware of racial prejudice when growing up in Atlanta.
I was raised and grew up on Auburn Avenue in Atlanta, and in front of our house was a store, and this store was owned and operated by one of the white citizens of Atlanta. They had two or three children, and we were about the same age. When we were 3 and 4, we played together, and this was not an unusual thing. But I never will forget when the day came that my playmates, my inseparable playmates, just found excuses and refused to play with us. And My brother was concerned about this. He was a year young, and I was very much concerned. And then this continued for a week or two, and I started talking with my mother about it. And for the first time, I came to see the problems, because she tried to explain the best way she could to a child just 5 years old the problems which Negroes confronted in the South as a result of the legacy of slavery and then segregation.
It must be a very difficult job for any mother. I wonder if any mother really can explain this to a child, especially a sensitive child.
Well, it's almost impossible to thoroughly explain it. The only thing that the mother can do, the Negro mother, is to try from the beginning to instill in the child a sense of somebody-ness. This was what my mother tried to do. She made it very clear that in spite of these conditions, you are as good as anybody else, and you must not feel that you are not. And this was her way of saying you should not have an inferiority complex. Now, this is very difficult because, I mean, even though you say this in words, it's very difficult for the child not to develop unconsciously this sense of inferiority, because he lives every day in the midst of a system which stares him in the face saying you are less than, you are not equal to. And the tendency is to develop this sense of inferiority because of the existence of the system.
Did you develop a sense of inferiority?
Well, I don't think it was ever serious. I'm sure some things worked on my subconscious self, but I don't think I ever felt a conscious sense of inferiority. I always felt from the example and the words that my mother had given all along that that I was somebody, and that all Negro people had dignity, even though the system of segregation deprived us of so much.
Did you have an opportunity for remaining in the North after you finished your doctorate?
Yes, I did. When I finished my work at Boston University, one or two churches in the North, one in New England and one in New York, expressed an interest in calling me to serve as pastor. And then one school in Pennsylvania had offered me a teaching position, so that I would say I had three offers to stay in the North after I finished Boston University.
And yet you went to Montgomery, Alabama instead. Why?
That's right. Well, I had a great concern for and commitment to the whole problem of racial injustice, of solving the problem, I should say. I became very concerned about it in my early childhood, and in my teenage days, this problem became a greater concern. And I said from the beginning that in some way I wanted to be a part of solving this problem. So that when I went off to school and faced the temptation of staying in the South, staying in the North, something continued to remind me that the South needed persons to return, and persons who would return and work directly in the field of civil rights to make conditions better, so that I came back with a conscious desire to do something about the problem which existed here.
Did you come back also with a plan of action?
Not any detailed plan of action. When I went to Montgomery, Alabama, I had no particular program worked out that would engulf the total community. I simply thought in terms of making the social gospel a reality wherever I could, and certainly in my own church.
That's Martin Luther King Jr. speaking to reporter Eleanor Fisher in November of 1961. Our thanks to the WNYC Archives and archivist Andy Lancet for making it available. Just weeks after this conversation, Dr. King attended an anti-segregation rally in Albany, Georgia. He was arrested, along with many of the protesters. He was eventually sentenced to either 45 days in jail or a $178 fine. He chose jail. It's on Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. Tomorrow marks 50 years since Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s death. We'll spend the hour looking back at his legacy with those who knew him and those who try to embody him. What does King's legacy mean to you is the question. Give us a call at 404-500-9457. You can also reach us on Twitter. Our handle is OST Talk. And be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more.
When white America killed Dr. King last night, she opened the eyes for every black man in this country.
That's civil rights firebrand Stokely Carmichael reacting to King's death in 1968.
He was the one man in our race who was trying to teach our people to have love, compassion, and mercy for what white people had done. When white America killed Dr. King last night, she declared war on us.
A new book explores the public's reaction to King's death. It's called The Heavens Might Crack. I spoke with its author, Jason Sokol. Jason Sokol, good to have you on the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Tony.
You know, Jason, I've read some really nice reviews of your book. I want to share a piece of one right now and ask you a question on the back of it. In recommending your book, the Boston Globe's Nina McLaughlin writes that your book looks not so much at King himself as it does at the impact of his death and how it opened a wound in the country that has yet to heal. Boy, there's so much to unpack there. But what story did you set out to tell, and where did the research lead you?
Well, I wanted to understand how people experienced the moment and the aftermath of King's assassination. And really, I found that was a great way of understanding what King's impact on people was. So I wasn't, you know, focused primarily on his life. I mean, we have a lot of amazing books on his life, but on the impact of his death and on his influence on other people.
You know, that's interesting. You talk about people experiencing his death in the way that they did. I want to play this clip because it's famous. Here's how legendary CBS News anchor Walter Cronkite literally brought the nation news of King's assassination.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police have issued an all-points bulletin for a well-dressed young white man seen running from the scene. Officers also reportedly chased and fired on a radio-equipped car containing two white men.
Jason, what did you hear from people in doing the research for your book about the impact of not just the news, but how they received the news from Walter Cronkite?
Well, I think, you know, nowadays, King is clearly an all-American hero. He's revered by people of all races and ideologies. What struck me was the diversity of responses to his death. Mm-hmm. So we think of it now, it must have been a national tragedy, must have been a time of coming together. But I think it was really a time of breaking apart. I mean, I was struck by the number of white people who expressed glee at King's death. I mean, and this was not only people in, you know, Mississippi and Memphis, but also I looked at letters people wrote from Michigan and Chicago and New York. There was also a diversity of response in the black community. There were some African Americans who turned to violence in the aftermath of King's death. There were millions more who gathered together and mourned and grieved in peaceful and interracial marches. So there's really, you know, that wide array of responses to King's death.
You know, that's interesting. We tend to forget, don't we, how polarizing a figure King was in his time, correct?
He was extremely polarizing, and that's especially true in the last couple years of his life. When he had 1967, he spoke out forcefully against the Vietnam War in his speech at Riverside Church, New York City. And after that, he was roundly denounced by people across the political spectrum. And then 1968, he was launching his Poor People's Campaign. And a lot of the policies he advocated in terms of economic justice, he wanted an annual income guaranteed for every citizen. He wanted a job for everyone who wanted one, billions of dollars from the government for affordable housing. And he was a democratic socialist. And so the intensity of the hatred toward King just ratcheted up in those last months of his life.
So let me play a clip from King speaking about the war in Vietnam.
So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schools.
Jason, I want to ask you a bit of a longish question. So yours is not a book about the assassination or James Earl Ray, but did you have to answer the question? And the question being why King was assassinated before you could write a book about the impact of his assassination.
You know, after his assassination, Ralph McGill, publisher of Atlanta Constitution, wrote a column, front page column. And Mike Royko, another famous columnist in Chicago, wrote a column for the Chicago paper. And they both came to the same conclusion, which was that King might have been killed by this one trigger man, and they didn't know it was James Earl Ray who did it at that moment. But what they said was that all American society was guilty and all white society was guilty. And what they meant was that King had received this increasing scorn and revulsion, and yet no white leaders stood up to stop it. Nobody said, you know, President Lyndon Johnson had broken with King at that point, and he was being criticized and denounced on the floor of the Senate and the House. So these two columnists really thought that all of white society had to sort of take responsibility for King's murder.
And let me play clearly his most famous speech, a portion of it, and then we can talk about the role of this speech in turning King into an icon.
I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, and every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with.
So, Jason, what is the role of this speech? And again, we're talking about a small portion of the I Have a Dream speech here in turning King essentially from person to icon.
Yeah, well, certainly one of the most famous lines of that speech is when King says that he longed for a day in which his children would be judged not for the color of their skin, but for the content of their character. And that was the sort of colorblind ideal that a lot of white Americans could really embrace. And nobody knows a lot about some of the other lines of the speech. For instance, King talked about the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. That's a quote. And people, you know, we don't think of him as someone who would be standing against, or at least a lot of white Americans don't think of him as somebody who would standing against police brutality. He talked about the whirlwinds of revolt that would shake the nation if justice didn't come soon. So, I mean, even in that, most seemingly moderate of his speeches, he said things that were fairly radical and revolutionary. And I think it's a case of Americans selecting what they want to remember about King and forgetting the rest.
So the title of your book is The Heavens Might Crack, and I'm speaking with the author, Jason Sokol. The great novelist and playwright, Jason, James Baldwin provides the inspiration for the title of your book.
Yeah, that's right. Baldwin wrote this amazing essay called Malcolm and Martin, where he reflected on the deaths of the two black leaders. And he includes his recollection of King's funeral in Atlanta on April 9th, 1968. And Baldwin, he was writing about the funeral, and he said the atmosphere was black with a tension indescribable. as though something, perhaps the heavens, perhaps the earth, might crack. And so that's and so I took that quote and did a little play on it for the title. And I think it captured a little bit of what I wanted to say about the impact of that assassination.
Yeah, here is James Baldwin talking about his friend, Dr. King, a month before his assassination.
And poor Martin spent most of his time in and out of jail, as all of us know, trying to redeem what we claim we live by, the principle of love your neighbor, the principle of if it happens to you, it's happening to me.
So, Jason, I've heard you in conversation talking about your book, and you've said that the final flicker of hope for a multiracial America went away after King's assassination. Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I mean that by the time of King's death, 1968, American society was becoming very divided. It wasn't so much a hopeful time of the early 60s, but it was a beginning of a sort of a fracturing. And that was not only between black and white, but also within the black freedom struggle itself. You had this split between the younger advocates of black power on the one hand and the more mainstream civil rights leaders who were still clinging to sort of legalistic and nonviolent approaches on the other. And I think King was one of the last people who was still trying to build bridges and who were still trying to unify. And he was the last, one of the last African-American leaders who still had legitimacy, both with Stokely Carmichael on the one hand and someone like, you know, Roy Wilkins, NAACP, on the other. He was somebody who's still trying to talk to the two worlds.
Yeah.
And also trying to talk to both black and white worlds at the same time.
That's Jason Sokol, author of the new book, The Heavens Might Crack. About a decade after King's death, President Jimmy Carter posthumously awarded him the Presidential Medal of Freedom. On Second Thought, producer Sean Powers takes us back to that day at the White House with this audio postcard.
When I was a child in Georgia, there was another threat which afflicted us, and that was racial discrimination, a deprivation of human freedom, and a prohibition against the realization of the American dream for black people.
Selma sprang overnight from an obscure southern town to the front pages of world newspapers. This church was headquarters in the Negro drive for the right to vote. And it was here that Martin Luther King came to lend his support to the campaign. He pointed out,
as you may know, the Medal of Freedom is the highest civilian award that's given in our country. There are many Americans who do great things, who make us proud of them and their achievements, and who inspire us to do better ourselves. But there are some among those noble achievers who are exemplary in every way.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
The President of the United States of America awards this Presidential Medal of Freedom to Martin Luther King, Jr. Martin Luther King, Jr. was the conscience of his generation. He gazed upon the great wall of segregation and saw that the power of love could bring it down. I'd like to ask Coretta King and Dr. Martin Luther King, Sr. to come and stand beside me.
It is highly significant that you, Mr. President, a white Southerner, would become the first American president to recognize the importance of Martin Luther King, Jr.'s contributions to the human rights movement in this country and bestow upon him the highest civilian award, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. For us as a family and the millions in our nation who believed in Martin Luther King Jr.'s teaching, we are greatly encouraged and feel this action is indicative of the new spirit of reconciliation which you and your administration are causing in this nation. Thank you, Mr. President, for renewing our hopes that our nation can rise to true greatness and give due honor to one of its greatest national heroes.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time.
And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
It's been a long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes it will.
A look back at President Jimmy Carter in 1977, awarding the Presidential Medal of Freedom posthumously to Martin Luther King Jr. That story was produced by On Second Thought, Sean Powers.